Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Ezra chapter 6. We're going to cover the whole chapter, verses 1 through 22. We will call this chapter, The Temple is Finished and Rededicated. Our context is this. In the last chapter, Ezra chapter 5, the exiles, having returned to Jerusalem, began rebuilding the temple again in 536. They had laid the foundation, and then they quit building because of opposition, and they never got started again because they got lazy and they were building paneled houses then for themselves. And then Haggai started preaching to them, and after that, they started rebuilding again. But then as they start rebuilding again, then some Persian officials who were the rulers of the province beyond the river, i.e. the Syrian and Palestinian area of the Persian Empire, they look at this temple and they say, wait a minute. So they sent a decree to Darius and says, they're rebuilding the temple. What do you think about this? And the Jewish exiles had told the two Persian officials, hey, Cyrus gave us the right to come back to Israel to rebuild our temple. So why don't you go ask Darius to look in his archives and he'll find Cyrus's edict, which is 539 BC, that gave us the right to come back here and build this temple. So that's where we are in Ezra, as we start Ezra 6, verses 1 through 5. Then King Darius. Now, Darius ruled from 521 to 486. This is Darius the Great. He's the same Darius that tried to beat the Greeks at the famous Battle of Marathon in 490. He's the same Darius who had one of his cities in Ionia on the western coast of Asia Minor before this burnt to the ground. I forgot which one it was. And as a result, he shot an arrow in the air and said, I'm going to get Athens. And he had a servant. Every time he would sit down at a meal, I want you to say three times, remember Athens. So he's a famous guy here. He issued a decree and search was made in the archives where the treasures were stored in Babylon. So they kept their history along with their money. And this was in Ecbatana, the particular place where they were looking in verse 2, in Ecbatana in the fortress, which is in the province of Media. Now, Ecbatana is a famous place if you read ancient history, classical ancient history. If you look at a map and look at the southern end of the Caspian Sea, right at the northern tip of present-day Iran, and then you go southwest until you hit the Tigris River, halfway in the mountains there is the city of Ecbatana, and I believe it was in the mountains. It was cool. I think it was the summer place for the Persians. I think they in Susa, which is due south about 200 or 300 miles. Susa's to the south. That's where they stayed in the months when it wasn't so hot. Then they would go back up to Ecbatana. So this is a well-known place. Verse 2, in Ecbatana, in the fortress, which is in the province of Media. Media, remember, is the empire that Persia conquered. Cyrus the Great conquered it about 550 B.C., and so a scroll was found there in the treasure house of Ecbatana, and it was written on it as follows. I'm in verse 2 of Ezra 6. Memorandum. In the first year of King Cyrus. Cyrus, of course, ruled between 559 and 530 B.C. In the first year of King Cyrus, but this is not the first year of his reign, this is the first year since he conquered the Babylonians who had put the Israelites into exile. In the first year of King Cyrus, that's 539, Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God. Remember, this is the decree of Cyrus, which was found in the archives. We are now at approximately 521 or 520 in Darius's reign. So this is about 19 years or so later after the edict of Cyrus was written, and this is what the edict of Cyrus said. In the first year of King Cyrus, Cyrus the king issued a decree concerning the house of God at Jerusalem. Let the temple, the place where sacrifices are offered, be rebuilt and let its foundations be retained, its height being 60 cubits and its width 60 cubits, with three layers of huge stones and one layer of timbers. And let the cost be paid from the royal treasury. And let the gold and silver utensils of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar, that's the king of Babylon, who of course was the head of the empire that had been defeated by Cyrus, and let the gold and silver utensils of the house of God, which Nebuchadnezzar took from the temple in Jerusalem and brought to Babylon, i.e. in 586 BC, when Nebuchadnezzar destroyed Israel and burnt Jerusalem, Let these utensils be returned and brought to their places in the temple in Jerusalem, and you shall put them in the house of God. So there's a pretty detailed memorandum of what Cyrus had said, completely vindicating the Jewish exiles and completely convincing the two Persian officials, whose name I have not mentioned yet. Their names were Tatanai and Shethar-Bozenai. They were the governor. Tatanai was the governor. Shethar-Bozenai was his sidekick. They also brought some other officials to Darius to try to find this alleged decree of Cyrus. Now, as we see, the decree of Cyrus was a little bit exact. It even talked about how to build the temple, how high it should be, how many layers of stones and how many layers of timber, and also that the cost for this temple was going to be paid out of the treasury of the Persian Empire. Now, in verse 3, the edict of Cyrus said that the height of the temple was going to be 60 cubits and the width 60 cubits. No mention of the length, which is a little bit strange, as Colin Delitzsch pointed out. Those commentators say that the omission of the length is probably because the length was intended to be the same as Solomon's temple. Now, Solomon's temple was about 100 cubits long, which if you include the backside buildings and the porch. And so the assumption, according to Colin Delitzsch, is that Cyrus wanted the temple to be the same length, but the new temple was going to be even grander than Solomon's temple because Solomon's temple was only 30 cubits high. Cyrus here says 60 cubits high. The breadth of Solomon's temple was 20 cubits if you leave out the side buildings. Well, Cyrus wanted the temple to be 60 cubits wide, not just 20. Well, so there's a difference in the prescribed measurement of the temple that Jerubbaal and Joshua, the son of Jozadak, were going to build between that temple, the second temple, and the first temple, Solomon's temple. Here are some options to account for the difference. Matthew Poole says that Solomon's cubits, or he suggests as an option, that Solomon's cubits were sacred cubits, but Cyrus is mentioning common cubits. Poole says another way to reconcile it is that 60 cubits high was only the allowance for the porch. Solomon's porch was 120 cubits high, but Solomon only wanted a 60 cubit high porch because he did not want the temple to be as magnificent as Solomon's temple. He wanted to keep the Israelites humble. Option number 3 is actually the opposite, according to the pulpit commentary. Cyrus designed a bigger temple than Solomon, but Zerubbabel didn't have the resources to build such a big temple. And in my opinion, this is the best way to look at it. This is not a command to make the temple 60 by 60 cubits. This is a limit beyond which the Israelites were not to go. This is Matthew Poole's solution. Cyrus didn't want the temple in the future to be used against him, maybe like an arsenal or something, or a defensive fortification. So according to Poole, what Cyrus is saying here, you Israelites are allowed to build a temple any size you want, but just don't let it go over 60 cubits high and 60 cubits wide. Now, Cambridge commentary doesn't like Poole's suggestion. They say that this is too obviously an attempt to escape the difficulty because of the discrepancy of the measurements. This is too obviously an attempt to escape that difficulty to be at all a probable explanation. Well, we'll leave that one up in the air. That's a difficult question. It's a minor point. Now, in verse 4, when Cyrus says that the new temple for the returning Jews is going to be built from the government fisc, that shows how much Cyrus was serious about his repatriation program. He wanted the people of the empire who had been jerked around by the Assyrians, he wanted them to go back home so that they would prosper and produce tax money for him or tribute money for him. And so he says, it's worth it. Give the people their temple, let them be happy. They'll build up another kingdom of Israel, and I'll be in charge of it, and we'll all live happily ever after. Now, Cyrus's decree, which was found in the treasury at Ecbatana, stated that the temple would be built with 3 layers of huge stones and 1 layer of timbers. Now, there's a lot of scholarly debate over what this means, 3 layers of stones and a layer of timber. We do know that stone and timber is very costly and very strong, so that's nice. Well, Cambridge gives some options as to what it means. It could be 3 stone stories surmounted by 1 wood story, or it could be 3 stone layers surrounded by 1 wood layer, which is not quite the same thing as a story. It's a little bit, a layer would be shorter than a story. Cambridge mentions another option. This means three layers of stone with a wood backing on the back of the stone. I think the best option that Cambridge gives is that this is a reference to the construction of the walls of the inner court. We read in 1 Kings 6:36 concerning Solomon's temple, not the rebuilt second temple, but the first temple. He, Solomon, built the inner courtyard with three rows of dressed stone and a row of trimmed cedar beams. So you got the inner courtyard, which would be the court of the priests and the court of men. It's got a wall around it, and the wall would have three layers of stone with a wooden coping on the top made out of cedar. And Cyrus's decree is probably just imitating that, I suspect. Again, people debate that. We don't know for sure. We go now to Ezra chapter 6, verses 6 through 12. Now we're leaving Cyrus's decree now. Now we're going to Darius's words. Remember now, Darius takes over in 521. The temple is going reconstructed. Reconstruction on the temple is going to start in 520. The foundation having been laid in 536, but having been stopped because of slackness on the part of Israelites and opposition from their neighbors. So this is right around 520 when the temple's going to get restarted, and 521 when Darius takes over. And Darius is now speaking. He says, "Now therefore, Tatanai, governor of the province beyond the river," that's the river Euphrates. The province beyond the river would include all of Syria, Phoenicia, Palestine. In other words, this is Zerubbabel's boss, because Zerubbabel was in charge of Palestine. Tatanai is over him. He had a sidekick named Shethar-Bozenai. And Darius speaks to them and also to the other officials of the provinces beyond the river. Keep away from there. That's a standard Aramaic legal term, apparently. It means keep away. Leave them alone. Don't mess with their rebuilding of the temple. Verse 7, Ezra 6. Darius continues, "Leave this work on the house of God alone. Let the governor of the Jews," and of course that's Zerubbabel, "let the governor of the Jews and the elders of the Jews rebuild this house of God on its site. Moreover, I issue a decree concerning what you are to do for these elders of Judah in the rebuilding of this house of God. The full cost is to be paid to these people from the royal treasury out of the taxes of the provinces beyond the river, and that without delay." Now let's stop there. Remember, Cyrus's decree said the temple was to be paid for out of the Persian treasury. Now Darius is confirming what Cyrus said, but he goes further. He says, not just the general revenues of the Persian Empire, but the revenues that are collected in the province beyond the river. In other words, from the Jewish neighbors, many of whom had been giving them a very hard time. So that was kind of ironic. This investigation from Tatanai and Shethar-Bozenai could have been really bad for the Israelites. Instead, it turned out to be a blessing. Darius continues, "Whatever is needed, both young bulls, rams, and lambs, for a burnt offering to the God of heaven." Of course, he's referring to Yahweh, even though he doesn't believe in him. "And wheat, salt, wine, and anointing oil, as the priests in Jerusalem request. It is to be given to them daily without fail, that they may offer acceptable sacrifices to the God of heaven and pray for the life of the king and his sons. And I issue a decree that any man who violates this edict, a timber shall be drawn from his house, and he shall be impaled on it, and his house shall be made a refuse heap on account of this. May the God who has caused his name to dwell there overthrow any king or people who attempts to change it so as to destroy this house of God in Jerusalem. May the God who has caused his name to dwell there in Jerusalem overthrow any king or people who attempts to change it," the "it" being the decree that he's now issuing, "so as to destroy this house of God in Jerusalem. I, Darius, have issued this decree. Let it be carried out with all diligence." Now in verse 10, Darius says he wants the people of Israel to pray for the life of Darius and Darius's sons. Now, Cyrus doesn't believe in Yahweh. He's just covering his bets. He's probably got every pagan in his empire praying to their gods for him, so he figures, well, let's let people pray to Yahweh too. This is sort of a typical superstitious way that kings believed back then. Now, to show how serious was about this decree, anybody who tried to destroy the temple or stop the building on the temple by violating Darius's edict here, a timber shall be drawn from that person's house, and that person shall be impaled on it. In other words, dropped so that the timber pierces him through his midsection. That's serious business. It's so ironic. This pagan empire is now protecting the Jews, and this just shows how the sovereign hand of God uses pagan nations to protect his people. America is a pagan country, but he could use America to protect his people and has in several times, especially in the legal system recently as the persecution mounts. As I speak, there's been a leak of a pro-life draft by Justice Alito of the U.S. Supreme Court, who says that the court is thinking very strongly about overturning Roe v. Wade and the baby killers, who are absolutely fanatic because they have suppressed the truth and righteousness so long that they've become wild with frenzy. They're now out there threatening to protest around the justice's house. And of course, the present administration, whose name I'm not going to mention because I don't want to use profanity in a podcast, they've said, no, we're not going to object to that. Go ahead and protest the Supreme Court. And they're putting graffiti on the walls, on the doors of churches that say, my body, my choice. They don't mention the body of the babies they're killing, of course. And so the persecution is there. Well, the government of America is totally pagan, but it is possible that the government of America can protect Christians, just like here, the government of Persia protected the chosen people of God. It's not guaranteed. The government can also persecute the people of God, as we see in China. But God is sovereign. He can do a lot of stuff messing around with the sinful, viciously sinful nations of this world. Now, Darius essentially issues a curse on anybody who tries to stop the rebuilding of the temple, who tries to destroy the temple. He said, may the God who has caused his name to dwell there in Israel, absolutely true, may that God overthrow any king or people who attempts to destroy the house of God in Jerusalem. Well, Walvoord and Zuck, in an interesting article, says that yes, Darius' curse was actually fulfilled. And think about this. Antiochus Epiphanes, the famous Seleucid governor, the Syrian governor in the intertestamentary period, he desecrated the temple in a famous incident in 167 BC. That's when he sacrificed pigs and spread pig broth all over the temple and basically really tried to stick it to the Jews. He died insane 3 years later. And of course, the Romans destroyed the temple in AD 70. A couple hundred years later, their empire was gone. And Walvoord and Zuck even mentioned Herod the Great. He did destroy the temple, but he added extensively to the temple to glorify himself. And he, of course, had horrible domestic trouble. He killed one of his wives. He killed at least one of his sons, if I remember correctly. He died a horrible disease. As Josephus says, he had burning fever, ulcerated entrails, foul discharges, convulsions, stench, etc. Although that's not exactly destroying the temple. That's adding to the temple. But at any rate, I think that Walvoord and Zuck have a good point here. That temple was supposed to be the place where God met his people on earth. That temple was the new Garden of Eden where God dwelled with his people. It was how a holy God could cohabit with his people in this sinful world. And you're going to tear it down? You're going to burn it to the ground? Lots of luck with that one. Now, of course, the temple had lost its holiness when Antiochus Epiphanes and the Romans burned it down. So we've got to remember that. I mean, Jesus actually predicted the destruction of the temple in AD 70 in the Olivet Discourse when he said one stone would not be left on top of another. That was condign punishment. So we might want to question Walvoord's and Zuck's stating of the destruction of the temple as being a fulfillment of Darius's curse here. It might have just been straight out punishment. But I thought it was interesting. We move now to Ezra 6, verses 13 through 15. Then Tatanai, the governor of the province beyond the river, Shethar-Bozenai and their colleagues carried out the decree with all diligence. Now, Shethar-Bozenai is Tatanai's fellow official of the so-called province beyond the river, which is an Assyrian administrative unit. They carried out this decree to let the temple to be built. They did it with all diligence, just as King Darius had sent, or as the Holman Christian Study Bible says, as King Darius had decreed. And the elders of the Jews were successful in building through the prophesying of Haggai the prophet and Zechariah the son of Iddo. And they finished building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. This temple was completed in the third day of the month Adar. It was the sixth year of the reign of King Darius. Now, Haggai gets an honorable mention here for encouraging the people to build the temple. He also had a fellow prophet that was prophesying at the same time, right before 520. That would be Zechariah, the son of Iddo. That's the canonical Zechariah, whose book we will study when we get there. Likewise with Haggai. Now, the building, the temple, was finished Well, it doesn't say the temple they finished building. That would include, as we look at all these decrees here, that would include not only the temple, but the walls, the city, and so forth. They finished building according to the command of the God of Israel and the decree of Cyrus, Darius, and Artaxerxes, king of Persia. So let's look at these decrees here. Three kings, and there were four decrees issued by three kings of Persia. And it is so important to learn these decrees and their dates because of the book of Daniel. The 70 weeks, highly controversial, highly difficult. I can't wait to get there. It's probably going to cause me to lose sleep. It's so complicated. I've done a YouTube video on the 70 weeks of Daniel. I remember one of the slides of that video says that the 70 weeks of prophecy is the black hole. What is it? The black hole of the fever swamp of biblical exegesis because it's so difficult. Well, in order to tackle that problem, you have to know these dates. So we're going to go over them here. The first decree is by Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Second, or Cyrus the Great, 539 BC. Now, Wikipedia gives this date, and a lot of people give 539 as the date of the first decree, the Edict of Cyrus that says you can go back, Jews. You can return from your exile, go back from Babylon, back to Israel, back to Jerusalem and the surrounding cities. 539 is a common date. I have seen other dates. Again, dates are all, you can always find somebody to come up with a different date, but this is a standard date. Now, the mention in Ezra of this edict, Cyrus's edict to rebuild the temple, doesn't mention rebuilding the city, just the temple. But Isaiah's prophecy about Cyrus does mention the city, Isaiah 44:28, who says to Cyrus, my shepherd, this is God who says to Cyrus, my shepherd, he will fulfill all my pleasure. And says, and God says to Jerusalem, she will be rebuilt, and of the temple its foundation will be laid. Jerusalem, she will be rebuilt. That's the city, and of the temple its foundation will be laid. That's the temple. So Cyrus's date, rebuild the city and the temple, 539, his decree. And then Darius I, this is where we are now, the decree that was found in Ecbatana in the treasury there. This is right around 520. We know that it's around 520 because the decree must have come out shortly before the restart of the build, and that was 520 BC. So that was permission to rebuild the temple, all the cities not mentioned, the city of Jerusalem. The third decree is that of Artaxerxes I. Now, Artaxerxes I ruled from 465 to 424, and so we're talking a good bit past the rebuilding of the temple, which was 520 to 516. But this is the third decree. It was the first decree of Artaxerxes I, but the third decree of the four relevant decrees, as far as the Jews were concerned. It was in the seventh year of Artaxerxes' reign. So you take 465 minus 7, and you get 458. A date to remember, that's the date that Ezra returned from Babylon to Israel. So Artaxerxes I, 458 decree, sent Ezra back to Babylon. You'll see that date quoted an awful lot. And then Artaxerxes I issued another decree, his second decree. Remember, he ruled from 465 to 424, right in the middle of his reign in 444. Easy date to remember. It was the 20th year of his reign. 465 minus 20 is roughly 444. And that was the famous decree that sent Nehemiah back to Jerusalem to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, which had fallen into disrepair. So there's your four decrees. Cyrus, 539, Darius, 520, Cyrus the Great, Cyrus the Second, 539, Darius the First, the Great, 520, Artaxerxes the First, 458, Artaxerxes the First, 444. Those dates should be etched in your memory. They should be branded into your skull. You should repeat them to yourselves at least 1,000 times every night before you go to sleep until you learn them. Now, why was Artaxerxes added in verse 14 in addition to the other two decrees, which had already been talked about by Ezra in this chapter, namely that of Cyrus and Darius? Why was Artaxerxes all of a sudden mentioned? Well, just to round out the account, because there was two more decrees that were relevant, and so Ezra mentions Artaxerxes because he's a player in this restoration of Israel. I mentioned the decree in the 20th year of Artaxerxes, the one that sent Nehemiah back to build the walls. Let me just quote from Nehemiah 2 verse 1. During the month of Nisan, in the 20th year of King Artaxerxes, when wine was set before him, I took the wine and gave it to the king. I had never been sad in his presence. Nehemiah is the king's cupbearer. drank the wine to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Drop down to verse 8, Nehemiah 2, and let me, Nehemiah says, let me have a letter written to Asaph, keeper of the king's forest, so that he will give me timber to rebuild the gates of the temple's fortress, the city wall, and the home where I will live. The king, that's Artaxerxes I, granted my request, and for I was graciously strengthened by my God. So there you have the decree to rebuild the walls, and we will get to that when we get to Nehemiah shortly. All right, we've taken a peek ahead into Artaxerxes' 444 decree that sent Nehemiah back to Jerusalem to build the walls. Let's back up and look at the 458 decree of Artaxerxes, the one that sent Ezra back to Jerusalem. We can read about that in the next chapter, Ezra 7, verses 12 through 17. Artaxerxes, remember that's Artaxerxes I, same Artaxerxes, 465 to 424. Artaxerxes, king of kings, to Ezra the priest, an expert in the law of the God of heaven. Greetings. I issue a decree that any of the Israelites in my kingdom, including your priests and Levites, who want to go to Jerusalem may go with you. You are sent by the king and his seven counselors to evaluate Judah and Jerusalem according to the law of your God, which is in your possession. You are also to bring the silver and gold the king and his counselors have willingly given to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem. Once again, more money going to the Israelites to help them build, this time from Artaxerxes' treasury. And notice he's sending not only Ezra, but priests and Levites, because he wants to see the law reestablished, because Ezra is a priest, learned in the law. So verse 15 again, Ezra 7, you are, Ezra, also to bring the silver and gold the king, I, Artaxerxes, and the king's counselors have willingly given to the God of Israel, whose dwelling is in Jerusalem, and all the silver and gold you receive throughout the province of Babylon, together with the freewill offerings given by the people and the priests to the house of their God in Jerusalem. So voluntary offerings by the people to rebuild the temple. The silver and gold you receive throughout the province of Babylon, I assume, is freewill offerings from the Israelites. Verse 17, then you are to buy with this money as many bulls, rams, and lambs as needed, along with their grain and drink offerings, and offer them on the altar and at the house of your God in Jerusalem. All right, so we see the purpose of these four decrees is to rebuild the city and rebuild the temple, to stock the temple with implements, gold and silver, to provide for the sacrifices that the temple needs to have in order to carry out the legal sacrifices, to support the priests, to do everything that the Israelites had before they screwed up and got exiled to Babylon. So Ezra 6, verse 15, back to our text. Ezra says the temple was completed on the third day of the month Adar. Now, Adar is February, March. It's the 12th month of the religious year, 6th month of the civil year, 12th month of the religious sacred year. It's the month before the first month of the religious year, which is Nisan. Now, Walward and Zuck, this article I found helpful, they have a different date for the start and ending date of the building of the restored temple. Most people have the Israelites starting in 520 and finishing in 516. Walward and Zuck have them starting in 521 and finishing in 515. Now, just to show you that not everybody agrees on these dates all the time. But they did some calculations on some lengths of time that had passed. For example, the foundation was laid in 536, so 21 years later they get around to finishing the temple. It took them 21 years after they laid the foundation, which is really pathetic. That's because they built paneled houses for themselves, and they stopped building because of opposition from the neighbors. Walward and Zuck have the finishing of the temple at 4.5 years after Haggai began his prophesying. So apparently Haggai started right before the beginning in 520, and it took them maybe a half year before they started, and 4.5 years after he prophesied, they finished. And Walward and Zuck say that the finishing of the temple was 70.5 years after the temple had been destroyed on August 12, 586. That's getting a little precise for me, but I like that date for the 70 years of Jeremiah. Destruction of the temple, 586. Finishing the temple, 516. 70 years. We go now to Ezra 6, verses 16 through 18. And the sons of Israel, the priests, the Levites, and the rest of the exiles, celebrated the dedication of this house of God with joy. They offered for the dedication of this temple of God 100 bulls, 200 rams, 400 lambs, and as a sin offering for all Israel, 12 male goats, corresponding to the number of the tribes of Israel. Then they appointed the priests to their divisions and the Levites in their orders. for the service of God in Jerusalem, as it is written in the book of Moses. Now, of course, the book of Moses is the Levitical law, and I'm not going to go over that again. I went through that in much detail. I have a question I've just asked myself here. The number of these bulls, rams, and lambs, and 12 male goats for a sin offering for Israel, I don't think that's in the book of Moses. The regulations for what a sin offering was, and so forth, that is in the book of Moses. So I think this is an arbitrarily chosen number on the part of the Israelites. And the number of animals they offered was a comparatively small number of animals compared to the animals sacrificed by Solomon at the dedication of his temple, the first temple. The numbers offer a stark contrast. Solomon offered 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep and goats. Well, that's 142,000 animals. Here we have 700 animals. You can see there's a huge difference. We read in 1 Kings 8:63, Solomon offered a sacrifice of fellowship offerings, those are peace offerings, to the Lord, 22,000 cattle and 120,000 sheep. In this manner, the king and all the Israelites dedicated the Lord's temple. Now, one interesting point here is that the sin offerings that were offered to dedicate the second temple, the sin offerings were 12 male goats. Now, that's interesting because there's only two tribes now, Benjamin and Judah. The northern tribes had been scattered. Simeon was scattered all throughout the southern tribes, where they disappear because they never had land that was contiguous. So this number 12, you can get really bollocked up trying to count how many tribes are mentioned at a certain time. The list of the 12 tribes differs in different places. I have pulled my hair out trying to get it straight. Do you count the Levites? Do you not count the Levites? Joseph, well, he had two tribes, Ephraim and Manasseh. Oh, and Ephraim and Manasseh, or at least Manasseh, was split, so they had an eastern and western half Manasseh. And so you see there's lots of room for debate. But at any rate, 12 is the standard symbol for the tribes of Israel, and they offered 12 male goats, even though the northern 10 tribes were kaputsky at this time, having been destroyed by the Assyrians in 722 and having become lost and never coming back, at least that we know of, not back to Jerusalem. Now, this fact shows that the post-exilic community of Israel still envisioned a united Israel. That idea was hard for them to die, even though there had been, back in 910, a split of the kingdom between north and south, and we're now down to 516, from 920 to 516. What is that? That's over 400 years since they split, and yet they still had the idea, we're one nation under God, with liberty and justice for all. Ezra 6, verses 19 through 22. The exiles observed the Passover on the 14th of the first month. Remember, Adar is when they finished, which was the 12th month of the year, and now the Passover is the first month of the year, the next month. Nisan 14, famous date, and they had a Passover. Verse 20, for the priests and the Levites had purified themselves together, all of them were pure. Then they slaughtered the Passover lamb for all the exiles, both for their brothers the priests and for themselves. Talking about the Levites, they slaughtered lambs for the ordinary people and then for their brothers the priests, who were also from the family of Aaron, and for themselves the Levites. Verse 21, the sons of Israel who returned from exile and all those who had separated themselves from the impurity of the nations of the land to join them to seek the Lord God of Israel, ate the Passover. Well, now who are these people? Well, the returnees, the exiles came from Israel. They came from Babylon to Israel. And, of course, they celebrated the Passover. Then next, all those who had separated themselves from the impurity of the nations. Well, who were they? Well, they could be those still living in the land who had not been exiled, who managed to miss the trip to Babylon in 586 B.C. Remember, Jeremiah was one of those. He was back in the land, as well as a rump population, which eventually ended up hightailing it to Egypt. But those who hadn't hightailed it to Egypt, those who had remained in the conquered land of Israel, they might have decided, well, we're going to join our returning brothers, and we're going to celebrate this Passover. And Walward and Zuck even mentioned that Gentiles living in the land who decided they wanted to participate, they might have been included. Gentiles in the Passover, that's interesting. Verse 22, whoever these people were, this great swath of people, they observed the Feast of the Unleavened Bread 7 days with joy. The Feast of the Unleavened Bread proper is the 7 days after Passover. Nisan 14 is Passover. Nisan 15 through 21 is the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And as time went on, sometimes people would call the whole 8 days their Passover, or sometimes they would call the whole 8 days the Feast of Unleavened Bread. And so it's very ambiguous. Here it's talking about the proper Feast of Unleavened Bread that comes after Passover, because it says 7 days with joy. So that means Passover 1 day, and then Feast of Unleavened Bread 7 days. For the Lord who caused them to rejoice, giving God the credit here, caused them to rejoice because he got their temple built. We've seen how he worked behind the scenes with all these government officials to protect them and to encourage them and to finance them. God, the Lord, had turned the heart of the king of Assyria. And of course, that's Assyria's master now, Persia, but Assyria is mentioned. And God had turned the heart of the king of Assyria toward them to encourage them in the work of the house of God, the God of Israel. Of course, the king of Assyria here is really talking about Darius. Darius ruled Persia, which is present-day Iran, to the east of the Tigris River, but he also ruled Mesopotamia, present-day Iraq, to the west of the Euphrates River, between the Euphrates and Tigris River, and that's where Assyria was. And so Darius is the king of the region of Assyria, even though the kingdom didn't exist anymore. Now, someone has noted that perhaps the mention of Assyria here is an ironic reference to the fact that Assyria, which before had enslaved Israel in 722 BC under Sargon II, when Sargon II wiped out Samaria, the capital of northern Israel, and carried all the northern Israelites into exile, perhaps mentioning Assyria here is an ironic reference to that fact, that Assyria, which before had enslaved Israel, is now protecting her. And so the bottom rail has now become the top. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we have now finished Ezra 6. That prepares us to go to our next audio, which is Ezra 7, verses 1 through 28. We will entitle that chapter, Ezra Sent to Teach the People. I hope you stay tuned for that audio, and I hope you enjoyed this one.